I'm expecting.
Your running journey, or my running journey, I can speak for myself, is really that. It's your own. And it doesn't matter how fast you go, and it doesn't matter how far you go. It just matters that you go.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Reinvent Health Podcast. Here we get to chat to some of the world's most interesting and influential people about everything to do with physical, mental, and spiritual well-being. If you want to make healthy changes and live a better life, you are in the right place. Please don't forget to rate, leave a review, and share with everyone who wants to live their best life. And now your host, Nikki Robertson.
This episode is for anyone who's battling to get started. And by getting started, I mean starting a healthy lifestyle plan, getting moving, or even starting a new business. Zoe's philosophy of starting where you are with what you have is an inspiration, especially if you're feeling stuck. Zoe, thank you so much for joining me today. It is an absolute honor and a privilege to have you on the Reinvent Health Podcast. I'm absolutely loving your book. I'm loving your journey, and I'm loving all the themes that are coming up for me in your tale of how you got yourself from being, you know, just an average, normal human being like so many of us, to doing something that is, I think, superhuman. And I know there are millions of runners all over the world, but what it takes to get to a point where you can do something like a marathon after being ill is an enormous achievement. So thank you for joining me today.
Sure. So thank you for having me. It's just as much of an honor for me to be spending some time with you today. And by the way, I'm still very much an average normal person. I had this momentary blip in judgment. And yeah, running has definitely become an intrinsic part of my life. But yeah, let's rewind a little. So perhaps the elevator version, just sort of a little bit of background about me. I'm a chartered accountant by profession. So, although I'm probably not your average chartered accountant, I have got quite a strong right brain side, or artistic side as well. And yeah, so I guess that was one of my challenges at school. I guess that's where one has to take it back to. I was not one of the popular kids at school. In fact, I on odd occasion would be found reading books at break time and so on. I struggled to make friends. I guess possibly largely because my upbringing was very old-fashioned and very strict. And so my dad and my mom, very big part of, I guess, getting me to where I am today. That sounds a little bit cliche, but it is true.
Yeah, we are our story.
Mm. So, yeah, 100%. So, I mean, my dad, he was one of those, he passed in 2012. But if you read the intro to my book, you'll see, I mean, he was absolutely I idolized him. And one of the biggest disappointments in his life was the fact that I was useless at any form of athletics. And I had this pet hate of running, probably because I was in boarding school. And when one is in boarding school, you are obligated to participate in everything, whether you're good at it or not. And I was most certainly not good at it at all. So if you were looking for someone coming first from the back, that would typically have been me. So I found it very embarrassing. And I guess when I left school, I had this, you kind of get this idea in your head that, okay, I'm just not good at that and I'm not going to do it and I hate it. Little think understanding at the time that possibly it was just because I wasn't fit enough to be able to participate in the kind of sports that one gets at a school level. And yeah, then started working. I did kind of roll out of school, I must add that. I was rather large, probably because I was in boarding school. I used to enjoy finishing off the desserts on pudding days. So Tuesdays and Thursdays after everyone left the dining hall, I could be found polishing off the remaining custard. So I definitely rolled out of school. I was by no means a lightweight. But my weight never really bothered me, Nikki. I must be honest, it was never really a a thing until, you know, I had we all go through relationship breakups, I guess. But, you know, I tended to blame myself, and I was like, okay, maybe it's because I'm fat, or maybe I didn't look right, or whatever the case might be. And it was a bit of a growing process as well, not so much just about weight, but more
kind of normal.
You know, you're growing up, you know, you're trying to figure out who you are and where you're going. And that sort of led me to joining the gym, which I hated just as much. So I guess the bottom line is really I was never very athletic at all, probably right up until more or less 2016 or so. So I did the mandatory stuff. And then as things happen in life, sort of thought I had my life under control, which I think is an absolute myth, probably, if I have to acknowledge now looking back, one never really has your – it's completely – you know, you control what you think you can, but life has always got bigger plans for you.
Yeah.
So I got married in 2012, and in 2015, my husband and I share a love for the outdoors and adventuring and camping. And in 2015, we went on holiday to the Kruger Park. And to cut a very long story short, I started to feel ill at Kruger. I sort of felt a bit like flu, fever. Okay. Shaky legs, headache, your usual sort of flu-ish stuff. Came home, climbed into bed for a couple of days, eventually went to the doctor because I wasn't getting better. First doctor prescribed antibiotics, still didn't get better. So more than a week later, I went to see a friend of ours who's also a very good GP. And she insisted I go for blood tests, and almost immediately after receiving the results of those tests, she called my husband and said to him, you have to take her to the hospital. High infection rate. So, I mean, going to the hospital is not exactly something I really wanted to do, and especially because I didn't have much energy to do anything. I kind of remember opening up a bag and looking at my cupboard going, what do you pack to take to the hospital, you know? But we went to the emergency room, and very shortly after I was booked in, and ended up in ICU in a coma for 10 days. I don't remember much of that period of my life, to be honest. I woke up after the 10 days and looked at everyone and was like, what is everyone fussing about? I'm fine. But the doctors obviously didn't share the same sentiment. And they, during that period while I was in the coma, said to my husband, I was either not going to make it, or I was going to be incapacitated or, you know, mentally challenged if I came around. That was a very traumatic period, I think, for my family mostly. Me, I sort of came out of that kind of like, you know, I didn't really understand. I don't recall the 10 days passing at all. So maybe just for that, some of the stuff that they say was wrong with me, and I guess it remains a mystery till today, what caused my illness and what my illness actually was. Seems it was caused by some form of virus, but I had encephalitis or meningitis, one of the two. I also had jaundice, I had septicemia. I had an epileptic fit where I nearly turned the hospital bed over and they had to strap me to the bed. Some of the funny stuff coming out of that was I'm English by birth. My husband is Afrikaans, so we speak both languages at home. But I was non-responsive to anybody that spoke to me, barring the person that eventually took me for a lumbar puncture. And he didn't know that I was English. He spoke to me in Afrikaans, and apparently I responded to that.
Okay.
And that only. So weird. But, so I didn't know all of that, but you sort of wake up in hospital and it's all these beeping machines and nurses and blood tests and heaven only knows what all. But one of the biggest challenges or realities for me was that I wasn't athletic, but I was fairly competent and able to manage all my body parts. But going to the toilet, I couldn't really do that on my own. I couldn't really walk very well on my own at all. Initially, I think that was probably coupled a bit, obviously, with weakness from being, you know, in a coma. But so there was the lingering result of that was that all of this high fever, et cetera, affected a nerve in my left ear, which really badly impacted my balance. So you do learn a little bit as you grow up, but you've got to laugh because I really did look like a drunk person when I was around. And I had this tendency to veer off to the left. So, you know, and yeah, so to try and kind of combat that, my husband and I had words about it because I was like, I'm going back to work, I'm fine. Typical, stubborn. But he eventually won that battle and I checked into step down, where they just guide you through,
yeah,
you know, some of the after effects of what happened. Yes. That you can read a bit more about in my book, but they dealt with stuff. I had tinnitus or tinnitus, depending on which language you're speaking, in my ears, which was, oh man, it was awful. It's like when you watch the movies and then a big bomb goes off and then there's that humming noise that insisted, it was so loud, like it was dreadful. Sure. So yeah, I had to learn how to manage that. I still have that. It's not something that really goes away. But there was a lot of stuff, you know, they were worried about my motor skills, obviously. Yeah. So I went back to sort of grade one, you know, those books they give you where you have to trace the letters and the numbers. And, you know, I had to do a whole book of that. By the way, my handwriting's never been great. So, I don't think there's any coming back from bad handwriting. But, yeah, and eventually I landed up just spending time with the physio just to try and strengthen your core stability muscles and to try and get my walking and my, let's say, navigation skills a little bit better. Also part of the joke was I could walk backwards like a champion. I mean, it put me in reverse and I was fine. But going forwards, yeah, as long as we had, you know, if I was going around a rugby field, I would be great because I'd be doing left turns the whole time. But, and then she eventually sent me, we would walk every day as part of the therapy and we did like a little trail type walk, so off-road where there's, you know, it's not as easy to navigate. So initially she would obviously hold my arm or, you know, to support me and then we sort of graduated from that to me being able to do it alone.
Yeah.
And that sort of perpetuated after step down as well. I went to a biokineticist and also she recommended that I walk for 30 minutes a day. And that is where it started, I suppose, because walking for me is quite boring. And walking the same route every day, I was eventually like, no, I can't. And also, I mean, not to disregard, you know, I lost a lot of weight in the hospital, but, you know, your body does overcompensate. So whatever I lost, I picked up quite a bit as well. So that was a consideration at the time, but it was really never top of mind. Yeah, and then the one day I thought, okay, I'm going to see if I can run my walking route. And I should just note that my walking route is re-healing. So hills are something that I've had to come to love. But I honestly nearly died. I set off from the driveway. I don't think it's even 100 meters between my three lampposts. I really thought I was going to die. It was way worse than at school. It was terrible. And, I was sort of like, okay, maybe I should just quit. And then I decided, no, I'm not gonna do that. No one has to know how bad it was. Yeah, so I kind of adopted a bit of a, I guess you'd call it interval training, you know, walk two lampposts, jog two, and slowly but surely I was able to run the whole route. It was dreadfully slow. And I guess maybe that's, I was sort of reflecting before I delved into your podcast this morning. Perhaps that's one of the bigger lessons, you know.
Exactly.
Your running journey or my running journey, let me speak for myself, is really that. It's your own. And it doesn't matter how fast you go and it doesn't matter how far you go. It just matters that you go. And that was really how I ended up running an ultra marathon was just being consistent because I'm really not a brilliant athlete. As I say, I'm very much a normal person. I have normal person problems. I'm not one of those, you know, elite athletes that's going to go and win the next Comrades. That's not me.
Yes.
I run because I love to do it. I run because it's become like a comfortable space for me. And I did never ever think, by the way, and I must just add, my walking route was 3 kilometers. And when I managed to run that, you could have probably, if you told me I'd won a marathon, I would have felt as proud. And that sort of, I guess, prompts, you know, I am quite competitive by nature. So then I thought, okay, I'll try for a five. And it just pulled from there. You know, it's, I mean, running is like that. So if there are runners listening, they will all know that it is very addictive. Once you do it, there's no going back. The challenge is to just start and to push through that, I don't know, there's almost this like invisible wall in your head that you think you can't. And then one day you just can.
It is a mind game. It's all in the head when it comes to, and I think that's why, you know, when you referred in your book to the average age of, you know, men and women who compete or finish marathons. I mean, I think it was between 38 and 40. You know, that head game is not for young people, not for most young people.
No, absolutely. And I mean, the further you run, I think the more of a mind game it becomes. Your fitness becomes just almost an accepted part of that. But
yeah,
running a marathon is absolutely in your head. If you read my book, you'll also see, but I'm sure there's many people out there as well. Like it's, you sign up for a marathon and then your eyes was like, oh my God, I can't do this. Like, what was I thinking? That's like how many park runs in a row and yeah, so far. It's the thought in your head that you can't do it, you know, and that's my biggest downfall, I guess, in life, is I have this inherent fear of failure.
Okay.
And so, yeah, to sign up for something and then not do it is almost
not acceptable.
That's tantamount. Yeah, it's tantamount to failure. So, yeah, I mean, you kind of do these crazy things. I mean, if you told me when I was in the hospital bed that a couple of years later I crossed the finish line of Two Oceans, I would have laughed.
So let's pause there, because there was a doctor who said to you that, you know, you probably will get, you know, 70% of your function back. And when I read that part in your book, I was wondering what went through your mind when somebody, it's almost like they're issuing a challenge at you. It's not a diagnosis, it's a challenge. And that's how I read it when I was going through your story. So what went through your mind when somebody says to you, you can't do something, or you probably won't be able to do something? How does that work in your head?
In my head, oh man, that's proper negative motivation. Absolutely. That's like laying down the gauntlet. Don't tell me I can't do something, I'll show you. although I must be honest, at the time when I looked at him, I was a bit baffled, because I couldn't understand how he could come to that conclusion, remembering that in my head I felt fine at the time.
Yeah.
I wasn't speaking well. I hadn't tried to go to the toilet yet. I hadn't tried to walk anywhere at all. So little knowing that all of that was still lying ahead of me, I mean, my brain was working fine. You know, you sort of know. I mean,
yes.
Wake up, I could remember, you know, I knew the people were around me. I was completely lucid. And I was looking at the sky thinking, no. There may have been a few rude words in my head as well, listening to that, thinking, that's not going to, no.
Yeah.
I will show you. So, yeah, there's definitely an element of that. And at some point, Nikki, I think initially I probably started out on this journey to prove him wrong.
Yeah.
But it changed because you don't run an ultra marathon for anyone other than yourself, in my opinion.
Yes. Yes.
It's that's an enormous dedication of time, emotional energy, etc. So at some point, and I'm not quite sure at which point, but eventually I realized that I was doing this to prove to myself that I was okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's kind of an important part, you know, because I think if we take it back to, you know, the fact that I was never a runway model in terms of how I looked, it totally talks to, I think, what you're trying to convey in, you know, your podcasts and stuff. And why I think potentially I was successful in my running journey, because it was never a sole driving factor that now I wanted to lose weight.
Yeah.
But when you start to train for a marathon, your body kind of, you firstly appreciate what your body can do.
Absolutely.
And you start to understand how much stronger you are than you think you are. And then your body tells you, it tells you what to eat because you crave healthy food. You crave lots of water.
Yes.
You need rest. You need to do strength training. You need to be consistent. So that whole journey almost creates a fertile ground for very healthy habits. And they become habits. I mean, if you do something consistently enough, eventually it becomes part of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so yes, probably going through my head was no, okay, I'll prove you wrong. But that definitely changed for me over time.
Was there ever a time, you know, between the hospital, the step down, the rehab, where you started to doubt yourself, where you started to get frightened that perhaps, you know, you'd never come back from this? Were there any moments of self-doubt? No. Because it doesn't look like there were.
I had a wobbly at, I think it was the second day of step down. I had a serious wobbly because I'm very much like that. I'm very driven and I tend to portray this front to the world that everything is fine, but like a duck, right? So at the top I'm calm, but underneath I'm paddling furiously. And I think one of the things I probably could have handled a whole lot better was being a whole lot more empathetic towards my family and the people around me that had been through so much while I was so ill. I just dived straight into, I'm going to get better, I'm fine, I'll show you lot. And I rode roughshod over, I think, their emotions to a large degree. And trying to juggle all those balls kind of caught up with me on the second day of step down. I started to wonder, maybe I wasn't going to be okay. Maybe my husband wouldn't love me anymore if I wasn't normal. Maybe I wouldn't be able to work. And, you know, I allowed myself that one, and it was a pretty good pity party. I'm not going to lie. It was ugly.
Yeah.
I was on my own in the room, and I just, sometimes they say it's good to have a good cry. I had a very good cry that day. That was probably the only time where I really doubted that, where I let that, I mean, that was a big fear.
Yeah.
That the seed that the doctor had planted. It was really the only time that I allowed that. I had other wobblies along the way in terms of just doubting my own ability to complete a distance or achieve a time goal or whatever the case might be, but nothing comparative to the pity party day that I had at step down. No, and again, I mean, I kind of pulled myself out of that hole because I knew if my dad had been alive, he would have totally kicked my backside for being so pathetic. Because, you know, you have your cheerleading squad. We all have, I refer to it as my support crew.
Yes.
You know, you go through life, one thinks you go through life alone, but you don't. You have... I mean, it's a very important role that those people play, you know? And mom as well. My mom is an incredibly brave lady. So I've got very, very big shoes to fill in a way.
Yes.
And they don't tolerate pity parties. So I kind of put that in a box and I was like, right, you're just going to take it day by day, step by step, and kind of roll with it and see where it winds up.
Yes.
And that's what I did.
Another theme in the book is, you know, you can't compare where you are with where you've been. And I think that's a really important message. The reason I'm asking that is because I work with so many people, lots of women, who can't imagine, you know, doing half an hour's exercise a day. Because like you and like me, our experience of exercise and athletics and running at school was terrible. I can't speak for all school coaches, but I can say the vast majority of school athletics and sport puts people off exercise, can put people off exercise for life. If I had to, if I had to base my running off what I did at school, I would never have started running because they don't teach you, you know, what your coach, for example, teaches you, or how to pace yourself, or how to breathe correctly. And, you know, what would you, I mean, you, like you say, you're just as normal as anybody else. What was it, I suppose, I'm guessing here, please correct me, it might have been the fact that you had to walk for rehab that got the journey started for you. But what would you recommend for or suggest to somebody who's desperate to sort their life out, desperate to get exercising. Where do you start as somebody who's just a normal human being who feels like they will never achieve even a park run? Where do you, how do you find that within you to get going?
So I guess it's, first you have to make the decision that you actually do want to do something, and you have to do it for the right reasons. So, and that reason for me was just, you know, I needed to make sure I was going to be okay. It wasn't, I needed to be thinner. It wasn't, I needed to, you know, I never set a goal of I'm going to run a park run or I'm going to run a marathon for that matter. Not at the beginning. At the beginning, it was, I started a habit, and the habit was very much get up, get a routine, put your shoes on, get out of the house. Yeah. So, you know, and it doesn't have to be for long either, because the problem we live with in the current times especially is that life is so, so busy. And, you know, where do you find the time? But I mean, I guess to put it into perspective, we spend an enormous amount of time being busy, not, you know, busyness as opposed to just.
Yes.
And so if you take 10 minutes away from that and you take those 10 minutes to go walk around the block, it's better than not doing anything. There's a meme around, I'm sure you may have seen it, that says, you know, even a kilometer, you still, what, it doesn't matter how slow you go, you're still lapping everyone on the couch. Even if you just walk around the block once, it's a start. And you do that consistently, and then you commit to yourself, that's what you're going to do. And you carve out whenever it works for you. I mean, I run at crazy hours. Someone asked me the other day, how do I fit it in? But I mean, it's what I do, and it's my time in the day. It's the only time I have where I haven't got emails and people demanding things and meetings, and I can just be. You know, so it's time that's, it's priority. And I think that's really, you know, if you really want to do it, you will commit to it and you will make sure that it works for you, and you will take away the excuses that we tend to, or that I definitely use, like, oh, I haven't got time now because I have to go and do this, or so-and-so needs me and therefore I can't do, you know, my whatever. If it's important, you'll say, listen, I'm busy from X time to X time. I can help you after that. And it's about setting those boundaries to put yourself first, because that's really what it is, isn't it?
It is. And also you roped friends, your mom, you roped all sorts of people in to go and do park run or just to walk around the block. And, you know, I think it's also really important, because if somebody's expecting you to show up even at a 10K race in the rain in May, you'll do it because you've made a commitment, not just to yourself, but to somebody else. And I think we underestimate the power of people in our lives.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Actually, I forgot to mention that, and that's actually very important. I think, look, I largely train alone, although my running crew has been an integral part of that journey, because what you'll know as well as a runner, when you're training for a marathon, you have got these things that they refer to as long runs. Long runs are just so much easier to conquer when you have a group of people with you. But it's about committing to someone else, that you've got someone else to help you remain accountable for the goals that you have. So yeah. I think that is another way that one can do it. I think also, you know, there's lots of these training type programs and stuff out there, because one of the problems that I had was I could run a 3K, then I ran a 5K, then all of a sudden I was running a 10K.
Yeah.
And your body can't actually handle it. So what you sort of land up injuring yourself, or, you know, your body can't handle it. And then, you know, you think, oh, no, I can't do it. And then you fall out of the habit again.
Right.
So it's quite important to go ease into it slowly, not rush yourself, not put too much pressure on yourself. And that comes back to what I said initially, where I said it is your journey. You don't have to compete with your park run buddies that are running a sub-25 or a sub-25K. Honestly, just showing up is an achievement on its own, and you need to give yourself credit for those things, the little achievements along the way, because all the little achievements add up to big results without you even realizing it.
They absolutely do. So you eventually, you know, you found the park run, and for many people, that is the start of our running journeys. It's a safe space. It's the most ingenious thing that was ever created as far as running is concerned. And I remember you were saying in the book that Bruce Fordyce was announcing the inaugural park run at the place that you were running. And I think that's also like experiences like that can be so pivotal where you realize maybe there's something bigger here. So talk us through your park run journey as well. And how, you know, if I always suggest doing a park run or a mile run for people who want to start out, because it's safe, it's organized, there's no traffic, it's managed, and it allays a lot of our stress and fear about how to get started. So let's chat about that for a bit.
Yes, I mean, I happened on park run accidentally, actually. I found an ad and it was obviously because it was an inaugural park run for one of the park runs here near where I live. And yeah, mom came with. I was totally overawed by the fact that Bruce Fordyce was there. I didn't realize that he was part of park run. I mean, honestly, I was like, wow, Bruce Fordyce. You know, I mean, goodness. When I was a little child, I would watch him on TV winning. And to just be able to meet such a legend was an incredible experience.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess it's, again, it's a part of that running journey. It becomes a thing. Even now, Saturdays are a day that I look forward to. We've actually renamed Saturdays to park run days, you know, in my circle of friends here. And it's honestly a day that I really look forward to being with the people. And, you know, again, it's not about time. It's some days you race it, some days you walk it, other days you do both. It's about the fact that everyone is out there enjoying, you know, being outdoors, being healthy enough and fit enough to get around a 5K track, because we must remember some people aren't able to do that. So yes, it is a privilege, and it does remind you that, you know, 5Ks is also a good distance. If you're training for a marathon, there's a very easy trap to fall into, that you have to run a 10K every day or whatever the case might be, or, you know, only a proper runner, and I use the word proper in inverted commas, if you're running a half marathon or if you're running a marathon. Mm-hmm. And I think park run has gone an incredible way to dispelling that belief amongst some of the, you know, let's say more hardened runners out there. Yeah. And yeah, so, but I mean, my park run journey, so I think I'm nearing 100 park runs. Wow. I've got a couple to go. Mm-hmm. But it started out really, I wanted to become a tourist because they had those cool orange caps. And I was like, where do you buy those? And they were like, no, you can't buy them. You have to earn them. And that was when I started to realize there were milestones, right, you know, that you can achieve along the way. So I set out to try and achieve park run tourist status. And I did my 50. Just before the whole COVID thing. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, parkrun has just been an integral part of my whole running journey. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, when I was training for a marathon, I would do what the crazy people in my head, I'm like, why would you run to parkrun? But I was one of those. I did run to parkrun, go home. But because it gave you a purpose, it gave me somewhere to go. It gave me somewhere that I belong, you know, and the people are just so... The volunteers and the people that I know there, it's such a community. Mm. It's a nice place to be. Mm. You know, it's somewhere that I want to be. And so I think, and the other thing that I see parkrunners doing now is they're also trying to dispel the myth that because there's the word run in the title, you have to run it. I mean, you don't have to run it.
Yeah.
When I was recovering from an injury, I walked quite a few parkruns, and you will never be the last person. That's what the tail walker is for, because I was always worried I was going to be stone last.
They make sure you're not.
They make sure you're not. And it's nice because there's also people of different experiences there. So you can, if you're not sure about, you know, I want to run a 10K, there's probably going to be a runner there that you can ask.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if you need to know about shoes or whatever, there's at least someone will know. And you just have to reach out. And, I mean, it's an incredibly supportive community in my experience.
Yes. You know, and that really is, you know, I think especially post-COVID is what people are naturally craving is community and a sense of belonging, because you don't always get that from your school days and your school friends or family or from work. But sport and a sense of community and support is really, really important for our mental health. And I really believe that's why things like this are growing so, so remarkably well.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so nice to see. I mean, our park, my local park run, there's a lot of little children as well, you know. So it's so nice to see the families together and the friends together. And it kind of becomes a tradition, you know. You see the same faces every Saturday and then we mosey on after that for a coffee.
Yes.
It's just a great way to start the weekend.
Yes.
Good vibes, you know. Yes.
And then from park run, you progress to finding a club. And that's actually, you know, that's where things change. So what happened next?
Yeah, so that was actually probably, I'm totally blaming my husband for this, but my husband, he knows me so well. So he reckons I'm like a diesel engine because I am not particularly fast, but I just keep going. And I was actually very offended when he told me that, but he's right. I'm built for distance, not for speed.
Yeah.
But the bearing in mind, of course, that he was a really good athlete at school, so he couldn't understand how it was that I could be so slow. And then my competitive side came out. So initially, I was wanting to train a little bit to get faster over a 5K, and I didn't really know what to do. And although my husband was good at athletics, he's a short distance athlete, so sprinting and stuff. I sort of reckoned, okay, well, let me see if I can join a club, you know, maybe there'll be a coach or there'll be some guidance. And yeah, so kind of the equivalent of opening a telephone book, I consulted Google and found a club nearby.
Yes.
And I kind of didn't have a choice there either. I arrived just to go and see what it was all about. And I met Lindley, and Lindley made the decision for me. It's like, oh, well, welcome to Irene. And I was like, okay. And yeah, he was also an integral part of that journey. He understood my competitive nature. He understood also, I think, far better than I did at the time, my capabilities. And he knew exactly how to, you know, manipulate the situation to get me to agree to crazy stuff. So it's thanks to him that I, you know, ran this kind of times. I ran on a 10K, that I ran a half marathon. It's all thanks to him. I mean, he was the one that planted those seeds. And yeah, if it hadn't been for his encouragement and his guidance and advice, probably the journey would have been a lot different.
Yeah, I think we underestimate the importance of coaching. You know, especially things like running, because a lot of us do it for fun and we do it for fitness and we do it on the weekend. But the minute you switch into a formalized plan with a coach, the entire game changes and you start realizing what you're capable of. And without accountability and without strategy and, you know, an actual plan, we can hover along being less than effective for most of our lives. And I think there's a good lesson in that.
Yeah, it's comfortable, right? So no one really, it's absolutely a comfort zone. You know, you get out, you do your thing. And I think COVID has also been, well, for me anyway, it was really just I train and stuff. But, you know, you've got no goals. You've got nothing to strive towards. So it becomes comfortable. So it is important to have some kind of structure, however one puts that structure in place. You know, not everyone can afford a full-time coach.
Sure.
But not everyone would see the need for one. And that's why, I mean, I say, if you've got a group of friends and you have certain goals, you know, there's lots of material out there, which at times can be confusing. But, I mean, I think you just need to understand the basic stuff you need to do.
Yeah.
The key for me was just to have someone there that I respected and that would tell me, listen, okay, you know, you need to do this, or your shoes are wrong, or whatever the case might be, because I didn't know what I didn't know. I mean, I was so clueless about all forms of running. I mean, when Lily told me I had to eat while I was running, I sort of looked at him. I'm like, how the hell did you do that?
Yeah.
What do you mean I have to eat while I'm running? I mean, that's insane. You know, and I mean, all of those kind of things, when you start to delve into the world of endurance sport in general, not just running, that, you know, that those, there's all those finer details. You will never figure that out if you just carry on in your little comfort zone, running around, you know, your local neighborhood.
So I 100% agree with that sentiment. I think it's very definitely a lesson one can carry through to other aspects of your life as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, all right, so let's fast forward. So you did your 21s and then you decided to do the marathon, the first marathon, I'm assuming.
Yes.
It's never just one. And, you know, what was going through your head building up? Let's not even go building up because people can read about that. But on that day, where was your headspace while you were doing this thing that you had never envisaged you would ever do? What was going through your mind at the time?
Well, before I started running, I was like, this is a crazy idea. I can't do this. I'm never going to finish. I was so scared. I was like sort of alternating between like hot and then I was cold and then it was awful. And then, you know, did I remember this? And I couldn't, like, where's my charger for my watch? And where are my shoes? And did I bring my brain along? I mean, I was in such a state before I got going.
Yeah.
And then, there was obviously pressure. One of the nice things, so the first marathon I ran was at Kaapse Hoop, which is just outside Nelspruit. And I'm not sure that they allow it anymore, but when I ran, my husband was allowed to second me along the side of the road. So it's a point-to-point route. So you start at Kaapse Hoop and you run all the way down into the Nelspruit Stadium.
Yes.
Mbombela Stadium, I think is the correct word. And so, yeah, I did a lot of research beforehand and when I'm supposed to eat and how much I'm supposed to drink, et cetera, et cetera. So it was, you know, my husband had very strict instructions about where he was going to find me and what he had to have, you know, which point he had to have a banana. And when I mean, I totally over-engineered this thing. But yeah, when I started, I you know, once you get going, then I was fine. I was actually fine. I did panic a little at the beginning because it was a congested start. So Lindley had these crazy time goals that he wanted. He didn't tell me what time I was supposed to run, but I, in my head, knew it was going to be some sort of crazy time. I mean, that's just his style. And I was sort of planning to run a 4:15, 4:30 marathon. And getting out of the pack at the beginning was just a nightmare. I think I was running on average 7.5, 8 minutes a K. And eventually I just sort of thought to myself, well, you know what, even if this is the only marathon you ever run, you're here, which is on its own an achievement. And actually you just need to finish. And it doesn't help that you freak out about time. Just enjoy it, you know, and it's a beautiful part of the world. I mean, there's wild horses that run there, stunning scenery.
Mm.
Yeah, and I mean, that's eventually, I stopped looking at my watch. I stopped panicking about my time.
Yes.
And I just kept going, I guess. And then, yeah, I sort of rewarded myself along the way. I mean, at that stage, I was fueling with jelly babies and I can't remember what all, but I remember eating a red jelly baby at halfway. Because those are my favorites. I like the red ones the best. And like, this is the furthest I've ever run. And then I saw my husband. So everything was fine until sort of the latter part of the race, because, you know, as husbands do, he says to me, no, you should catch the sub-4-hour bus. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, there's no way that I'm going to run a sub-4 marathon. No way. And remembering now, I haven't really been checking my time. So, yeah.
Oh, dear.
Eventually, I couldn't help myself check my watch and I thought, okay, maybe I can. But then I realized, I think I had 30 minutes left to run 5Ks, right? And I'm like, well, I can run a park run in under 30 minutes. No problem. Except they don't tell you about the last 10Ks of Kaapse Hoop. That is just uphill. And I mean, if you've been running downhill, for the preceding 32 Ks, your legs are hammered and it's hot and humid there. So then I had another little pity party walk up a hill. Eventually I bolted for the finish line. So yeah, I was very chuffed to have finished. Probably one of the best finishes I will ever remember.
Yeah.
We bought beer with a really disgustingly sweaty 50 Rand note out of my running pack. And I mean, it was early in the morning.
Yeah.
But I mean, a plane had gone overhead somewhere in the world. just as a celebration, it was a very special moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, so and I did
I did manage a sub-4, by the way, for the record.
So what does that do? I mean, you know, anyone who runs will know, but for those who are curious, what does doing that, completing a marathon like that, do for you? You're never going to go, well, that's it, I'm done. This opens up all sorts of ideas in one's head about what you're capable of. I mean, you've bashed some of your sort of preconceived ideas about what you're capable of over the last year, and now you do this. So where to from here?
Yeah, look, I mean, and again, that's, you know, from a running perspective, obviously. I mean, then once you've run a marathon, that bug has bitten you. There's no coming back. Then it's a question of exploring, I think. And that's really what running has been for me, exploring the different aspects of your running journey. You know, are you a marathoner? Are you a half marathoner? What, you know, where are you most comfortable? Because you also don't know until you've tried. And
sure.
I guess just that self-confidence that you invariably will get that. I mean, running a marathon is quite a, as I say, it's a mental thing. So that does give you a lot of mental strength for other aspects in life as well. Because it does hurt. No matter how hard you train, it's going to hurt.
Of course.
And, you know, being able to overcome that, you can just tackle a whole lot of other things in life with a sort of a view that, okay, well, you know, the marathon didn't sort of get me down. I can get through this. And there's a lot of lessons in your lead up to a marathon that are very much applicable. Yeah, to the rest of your life. So, yeah, but then, yeah, the question you asked now, what next? Well, I decided, well, you know, I've run 42Ks. Now I need to try for an ultra.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that was what I did. As crazy as that sounds.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I signed up for the Two Oceans Ultra, and that was definitely an adventure or a journey in self-doubt that I've never had in my life before. I totally psyched myself out prepping for Two Oceans. It was not an easy build-up to that. There were a whole lot of events and incidents that happened before I even got close to the start line that all sort of seemed to be conspiring for me not to go. And how did I get to the start? The same way as I got to the start of any other race was eventually I just broke it down into something smaller that my brain could understand and took it one step at a time. And I mean, some of the advice that I got given in leading up to the ultra was from another member of the club, where he recommended that I walk for a couple of minutes after every 6 kilometers. So you sort of push the wall, they call it when you hit the wall. You kind of push the wall out, or you push your fatigue out.
Yeah.
And that your body isn't as, you know, tired at the beginning. So you've got a little bit left at the end. And in my head, that worked for me because I was totally psyched. Like the fact that I had to run so much further than a marathon. And I mean, I knew how I'd felt at the end of a marathon. I mean, I was tired. My legs were sore, you know, and then I'm going, okay, but now you want to run another 14 kilometers on top of that. That's just nuts. Why would you even do that to yourself?
Damn.
And with all the other things that happened prior to me towing that start line, I very nearly didn't go. You know, I sat with a problem at one point. I had two entries. I had a half marathon entry and an ultra marathon entry. And then I didn't know which one I was going to use. Eventually, they sort of force you. You know, you have to make a decision. You have to pick your distance, pick your poison. And I remember phoning the lady at the Two Oceans office. And yeah, she thought it was very funny. She was like, "Are you going to run both?" I was like, "No." And, you know, when I had to make that decision, I think it had been brewing in my self-conscious or my subconscious for a while. She asked me, she's like, "So, my dear, which distance do you want to run?" And I just said the ultra. And I was like, "No, Zoe, did you just say that? What were you thinking?" But I guess it had been brewing on the back, you know. I mean, what's the worst that could happen? But I didn't run the normal route. I ran the route via Okapseweg because there was protest action at Hout Bay, so they changed the route. So I feel like I definitely have to go back because I definitely have to run the proper route.
Okay. So I guess, you know, the lesson is here, and this comes up a lot through your book as well, is it's more important to start than to finish. It's more important that you took the step.
Oh, yes.
That you started the journey. And I think a lot of people wanting to explore running don't realize that. It's the fact that you get up every morning, and even if you just go around the block, that's a huge achievement. It's not going to dictate where you end up at all.
No, look, so I mean, I think I know I have a lot of, you know, within my broader circles, I know a lot of people don't want to run or can't run or whatever the reason. So for me, it's about being fit. It's a way of life. It's about getting, you know, keeping your body in the best shape it can be, because you know, you need your body.
Yeah.
It's really that. It's that mindset of little bits of being consistent, committing a little piece of your day. I mean, it doesn't have to be a lot of time. You don't have to be on the road, or, you know, whatever your fitness of choice is. You don't have to spend hours and hours and hours doing it. Not all of us, well, me in particular, I don't have the luxury of being able to train for hours at a time. But the little bit of time that I do make available, I make that time count. And I think that's important.
That's a really good lesson, is to make it count. And then what drove you to write a book? Because writing a book in itself is a marathon event. So what prompted you to do that, take that step?
This is going to sound really lame, but my mother made me do it.
Yeah, I love it. Sounds like your mom made you do a lot of things along this route.
Mom is a very inspirational lady. Technically, I think she should be the one writing a book, because she's
like
got lots of adventures. But yeah, so what happened was she signed me up for a mentorship to write. I had written a few things before. Mm-hmm. Like nothing long format in terms of like a full on book, like short blogs and so on. I still do blog till today, but she forgot to tell me that she'd signed me up for this. It's like a mentorship program with the writing room, and I got all these emails to, you know, sort out the formalities. I sort of looked at these emails. I thought they were initially spam, and I sort of ignored them, and then they kept coming, and eventually I read them. And I mean, the only person that could ever possibly have prompted that would have been my mom. So I remember phoning her saying, "Mommy, what have you done?" And yeah, then, I mean, I didn't plan to write about this journey of mine either, because I obviously hadn't planned to write a book. So you go to the first meeting, and the first meeting is all these proper writers, and they all have their stories organized. And I'm sitting there going, what am I going to write about? I don't know what I'm going to write about. And yeah. I guess they say that everyone has a book inside them.
Yeah.
And once I started to write, it just came out. So that the bulk of my book I wrote at the beginning of lockdown. So when we were in hard lockdown. And yeah, it's not difficult for me to write long format though. So that, yeah. I must just sort of caveat it by saying that I do write for my work, you know, long reports and stuff like that. So I'm used to sitting and putting words on a page. But putting my story and my words on a page was a bit of it was quite cathartic, I guess. But it was also uncomfortable, I guess, because it makes you think about stuff differently than you know, you sort of go through the process and you come out on the other side. But you don't have to always reflect. So it did prompt a lot of reflection, to use the word. But yeah, I mean, recall correctly, when I started, it took me about 3-4 months to get my first draft together. And if I'd only known that was the easy part. The hard work only starts after that. But yeah, it's been its own adventure, this book of mine. And I think the reason I wrote it eventually was, you know, if it helps one person out there, then it was worth it. I didn't write it to be, you know, any kind of guru or expert on anything. I really just wanted to share with the person that needs it, and there probably will be someone that, you know, you don't have to be labeled by what other people say or think of you. You can determine your own labels, and the only person that's stopping you is yourself.
Yes.
And the negativity in, you know, in my world anyway, when I tell myself, no, you can't do this or you can't do that. So, yeah, I think that's really what I'd like the story or the message to be. There's a lot of others in there. I also include like 10 lessons that I've learned from running. Although that being said, I have learned so much from, you know, running continues to humble me and to teach me. And, I hope I still have a long relationship with running that lies ahead. So that was why I wrote it, because my mommy made me.
Oh, I love that. And yes, you know, I think that is, you know, we do these things because if you can just help one other person change their perspective, live a better life, change their mind, that's all we're really here for, is to pay it forward, is to take our experiences and pay them forward. And yeah, well done for doing what you did, accomplishing what you have, and having the bravery to put it out there into the world as well. Because that's very brave, is to write a book and put it out there, what you've been through. So yeah, I would highly recommend that anybody who's on the fence about getting their ass moving is to get hold of Zoe's book, which will be in the show notes. It's available everywhere. Every bookshop, it's available online, is to get some inspiration from somebody who describes herself as ordinary and normal, just like the rest of us. And just by taking one step at a time, you can do anything. And it's so inspirational. So thank you so much for putting it out there into the world.
Thanks, Nikki. And thank you so much for the opportunity to chat to you. It'd be a great time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you once again for joining me for another episode of the Reinvent Health Podcast. As usual, all of my guests' details can be found in the show notes page on Apple Podcast, Anchor, or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. Please don't forget to rate on Apple and leave a review.